Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Hej, välkommen till avsnitt nummer 2 av Hästveterinärerna. Podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med hästar. Även i detta avsnitt kommer vi lyssna in på mitt samtal med Martin Nielsen, forskare på University of Kentucky. I förra avsnittet pratade vi lite om hur han hamnade i Kentucky och även om vilka utmaningar vi står inför när det gäller att diagnostisera bland annat stor blodmask. Vi fortsätter i detta avsnitt med diskussioner kring riktlinjer, träckprov och fördelarna med att det är veterinären som avgör när och om hästen ska behandlas mot mask.
We're back here with Martin Nielsen, who is joining us to talk a little bit about equine parasites in this second episode of this podcast series about equine parasitology. And in the last episode, we were talking a little bit about diagnostics. But I wanted to talk a little bit about policy and ask you a little bit, because since you have the experience from where you are in Kentucky in the US, and you've also been in New Zealand, as you touched upon in your webinar, and you're also very familiar with how we have it here in the Nordics and our conditions here. And as you know, we have a pretty strict anti-helminthics policy where you always have to have a prescription to get it from the drug, the pharmacy store, and the fecal testing is either recommended or required. Would you say that, what are the pros and cons with this regimen, and also the opposite with what's the pros and cons with the routine administration and so forth?
No, those are great questions that I've actually spent a lot of time evaluating myself and studying. We completed a number of surveys, questionnaire surveys, that have looked into these things both amongst veterinarians but also horse owners. We published a multi-country survey 10 years ago now, where we had Germany, Austria, U.S. and Denmark in there, and the results were really striking and interesting. So I think overall the big accomplishment from this legislation was that we placed the veterinarian back in the center of this whole decision process of what should I deworm my horse with. And that's definitely a good thing, instead of having these decisions be in the hands of the horse owners and whatever they would base their decisions on. Someone else in the barn said something, or they saw an ad in a horse magazine, whatever they did, or just picked whatever was cheap at the feed store or Walmart for that matter. And so definitely we're in a situation that's much better off. They place the veterinarians as the key person in that decision. It kind of emphasize the need for those veterinarians to also stay up to date with recent findings and not just rely on, you know, what they learned in vet school, which could be decades or years ago, and sort of stay up to speed with what some of us are doing, and so the need for this webinar, for example. So I think that's definitely been great. And also think, based on our surveys, we can definitely say that treatment intensity has reduced significantly as a result of the legislation, and that was the whole purpose, right? So definitely we have less selection pressure for further development of drug resistance. We don't really have a lot of information about what are the levels of drug resistance in equine parasites in Scandinavian countries like Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland. I think that would actually be good information to have. It's a question I often get when I talk to people in elsewhere in the world. Mm. And so we don't really have a lot of information that's kind of sort of say, is it any different here than it is in other countries? The other thing that we can definitely see from the surveys that is very, very striking is the use of diagnostic surveillance monitoring of parasites, mostly by use of fecal egg count, is significantly higher in these countries compared to elsewhere. It just really, there's no real comparison. The only other country where we in recent years have seen a similar development is in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
United Kingdom is interesting. They used to be part of the EU. Now they're not, but they were at a time where, you know, the EU directive was introduced in 2007. And so they have prescription only, but they have a little bit of a different setup. It's kind of interesting. So they have three groups of people who can prescribe emphymetics. So there's veterinarians, there's pharmacists,
mm-hmm.
and then there's SQPs, special qualified persons.
Mm-hmm.
And those are people that take some kind of course, mm-hmm. and that authorizes them to prescribe emphymetics. So there's like this third sort of somewhat defined group of people that can also prescribe drugs. And that's very different than Denmark and Sweden, where it is only the veterinarian.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to also follow along with how that unravels and unfolds in the United Kingdom. They're doing a lot of surveys there. There's a lot of actually papers coming out right now on what the situation is like there. I think what we see is actually also an uptake of the use of fecal egg counts more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. So that's the big plus. And I think the disadvantage is, as I have seen it and experienced it, is whenever the thinking becomes too strict and too dogmatic. So I think it's a matter of there's a law that requires the veterinarian to prescribe the drug. That's great. But then there's also a matter of how you administer that law.
Yeah.
And that's a decision that sits with the individual country. And that's the reason why, you know, it's all the same EU directive, but in the different EU countries, you see very, very different policies for how this legislation is administered. And and you can be very strict. You can be somewhat less strict. You can be a little bit more flexible. I think what I've seen, certainly in Denmark at times has been, a lack of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been a little bit of a tendency of, you know, the veterinarian being so restricted by the law that they couldn't really be a veterinarian.
Mm.
I think a veterinarian is supposed to be able to make a clinical best judgment call based on the situation, based on the number of factors that they can take into account, knowledge of the farm, the operation, diagnostic findings for sure, but that's not the only thing, right? Age groups, clinical cases that have occurred on the farm, whatever it might be. And as I alluded to in my webinar, I mean, there are things you don't diagnose with the fecal egg count. The fecal egg count only tells us one part of the story,
definitely,
an important part, but not the whole
part.
And I think there's been a little bit of a too strict administration of the law occurring in Denmark. I don't know if it's been slightly maybe different in Sweden, but if the vets become too limited in what they can do and make the right decision, I do think it becomes a problem. And it's not a problem of being in violation of the law. It's a problem of how you decide to administer that same law.
Yeah.
And so I think there's definitely discussions that are needed to be had. And I have seen in recent years that there's been at least some flexibility offered where, for example, it's been allowed to prescribe emphymetics to foals at a certain age without a fecal egg count, simply because they may not be old enough to even have egg shedding aspirates. So there's been some modification there, which I think is very positive. In some of the limited, albeit, discussions that I've had with veterinarians that work for the Danish veterinary authorities over the years, and it's been years since I've had any, but I mean, when I've had them, I've also felt there's been a little bit of a tendency to applying the same thinking you would have with regards to antibiotics and bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So you diagnose an infection, then you treat with the appropriate antibiotic and you eliminate it and the problem is addressed, right? And some of the people I've talked to have been a little bit applying that same thinking to parasites.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've really been succeeded in really convincing them that it's different.
Yeah,
it's different because the parasites are always there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's not a matter of diagnosing an infection. They're going to be there whether you diagnose them or not. When we talk about the cytostomes, certainly all the grazing horses, a lot of them will have tapeworms. Mm. And every operation in these countries will have tapeworms, at least in some horses. Mm. And then if you have foals, they're all going to have ascaris.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So it's not a matter of if. Mm. No, they're going to have it, and they're going to come back. These parasites will come right back.
Yeah.
As I discussed in one of my webinars, you know, they come back sooner now than they used to. So it's a different way of thinking. So we're not eliminating an infection. We're trying to control parasite transmission. We're trying to control the infection pressure. It's a different dynamic. It's a different goal.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes there's been a little bit of a lack of understanding there. There's also been a reluctancy to even discuss these things.
Yeah.
No, we don't discuss the science. We just apply the law.
Yeah.
Well, you have to kind of consider the science. That should be what the law should be based on, in my opinion. And so, and I've also had, at times, again, years ago, some veterinarians being really upset with me because, they've been saying that, you know, some of the things you say, Martin, that would be breaking the law here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
My response, and that's a little bit provocative, I admit this, but my response is then change the law.
Yeah.
Because the recommendations are evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be restricted by a given, not a law, but how it's been decided to administer that law.
Mm.
I don't want to be restricted by that if I have a best evidence-based recommendation that's based on science.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to communicate that. Mm. If we then identify an issue with how a law has been practiced and administered in a given country, then we can discuss that.
Mm.
So sometimes we have a little bit of that. So I felt that there's been at least some stringency with how things have been administered. Veterinarians have felt that they could not administer antiemetics without a positive fecal egg count.
Mm-hmm.
And my comment has always been they should be able to.
Yeah.
Right? Because fecal egg count is only part of the picture. There are parasites that are not detected by the fecal egg count. There are stages of the parasites that are not producing any eggs. And those are the stages that are actually causing disease. Like we talked about Strongyles vulgaris in the previous episode of the podcast, it's the larvae that cause disease, right? And the same goes for the cyathostomins.
Yeah.
And so there's more to it. And how do we even handle the tapeworm situation? We do have, some diagnostic options there, but are all the vets then routinely checking all the horses for tapeworms all the time before they choose a combination product that happens to have praziquantel? And if they do without a tapeworm diagnostic, are they now in violation of the legislation? So there has to be some flexibility there.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been trying to communicate in the guidelines that we've issued for North America, where we have this two-tiered approach with the foundation of treatments that should be considered to keep some of the non-cyathostomin, non-ascarid parasites at bay. And then, you know, you do need the diagnostic information. Two, you cannot construct a good, solid, appropriate parasite control program without having your fecal egg counts.
Mm.
So those should always be in there. Mm. I mean, so you have to be evidence-based, you have to be surveillance-based. And so I think what I'm recommending is very much in line with what I consider the idea of the legislation, which is to be surveillance-based, evidence-based, and scientific veterinary medicine-based in your decision-making. Mm. And then the other part that I am emphasizing now more and more is that the most important thing to do above everything else, above what we've talked about thus far in this podcast, is checking the efficacy.
Yeah.
And that's a responsibility of the veterinarians who prescribe the drugs.
Yeah.
So I can say that much more easily here because I know here is the veterinarian's responsibility. Yeah. I can't really say that as much in the States, for example, where sometimes the vets are not there. They can suggest checking the efficacy, but they really need to convince an owner to pay for that in addition to paying for the drug.
Mm.
Here, I think it's a responsibility that we check that those products are still working the way they should be according to the label, and there are no safe drugs anymore. And when it comes to the cyathostomins and the ascarids, we've seen resistance to all three classes. So we owe our customers to routinely check every year.
Yeah.
And I think that goes before all of the other applications of those fecal egg counts. And I don't know, I mean, whether that satisfies the legislation or not, but that is just the right thing to do as a veterinarian.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of things that can be said about this. I think there are quite a lot of opinions as well, but I think you really nail it when you say that the veterinarian should always be in the center. That's sort of a prerequisite almost for when it comes to medicine.
Yeah, they should be in the center, and they should also be allowed to act as veterinarians.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and that applies. That includes some thinking and some multitasking, because there's a number of factors you take into play. There is more to it than just a fecal egg count. I mean, parasite control is not that complicated, but it's maybe complex. Mm. Right? And I think. I think there just needs to be some flexibility in there.
Yeah. What situation would you say it's recommended to treat without a preceding test? In what situation would you be like, that definitely should be treated, even if it didn't have one?
Mm-hmm. So I can mention a couple of examples. I think the easy one, the less controversial one is the Ascrids and the foals, where definitely. The prepatent period is 3 months. It takes 3 months for the parasite to reach egg-shedding patency. We know that the Ascrid parasites are actually acquired very early on. I mean, within the first couple of weeks of life, actually, which is kind of interesting. And so foals, and then they spend a little bit of time migrating, and about a month into the infection, they're back in the intestine, right? And then they grow in size, become longer and longer and thicker, and at somewhere in there, there's that risk of inducing the impaction. So if you wait too long and without deworming, and then you deworm them right at when the worms are the largest and the most, that's where you could have that impaction happening. And so we do recommend deworming them before you can detect them in the fecal egg counts, or with the fecal egg counts. And so that's typically 2 to 3 months of age. We don't want to deworm them earlier than that. And that's a discussion I often have in the US, where people are so used to deworming them monthly and they start at 30 days.
Mm.
So sometimes I do a little bit of a test balloon. Mm. I want to see how willing people are to change their habits.
Mm.
So I always start with a 30-day treatment and see if they're, you know, willing to even listen to my arguments. If they are, I know I can move on and then make additional recommendations. If they're not, I know, okay, this is going to be a tough one.
Mm.
And then I settle with, you know, pick your battle sometimes. So I settle with changing one thing at a time sometimes. Mm. And I often start with a 30-day treatment. The point with arguing against that, I know it's probably not going to apply to many of your listeners because they're not doing that anyway. And by all means, don't start.
Mm.
But the point with 30 days is that, you know, most of the worms will still be migrating.
Yeah.
They will not have reached the small intestine yet, or very few of them will. And in this day and age, with all the resistance to ivermectin, we don't have any treatment that will treat the migrating larvae.
Mm.
So we have to sort of wait for them to have reached the intestine. And that's beyond that first month. So that's why we say 2 months. If we wait until they're 5, then we have them developed into very, very big and large mature worms. And that's where we have that risk more of impaction. So the whole idea is, okay, if we deworm them early, then we can go in again before weaning, depending on when weaning is. But that varies. But often it's 5 months or 6 months or whatever it is for many foals. It's a very stressful thing in their life. I like the idea. I have no evidence here, but I like the idea of having at least eliminated a large, potentially large Ascrid worm burden prior to weaning. And then we know from the data, also some of the data that I showed in the webinar, that, you know, the worm burdens, Ascrid worm burdens, that is, peak at about that age, 5 months or so. Mm. And then they start declining. And then you need to sort of shift the focus away from the Ascrids and over to the strongyles and the tapeworms. And you need to monitor when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get into the 5-6 months age range bracket, maybe a little bit older, that's where you actually have to do fecal egg counts on your foals.
Mm-hmm.
But you do it with a different purpose. You do it to monitor, you know, basically ask the question, are there still any Ascrids around? Or are we now primarily dealing with strongjaws? Or are we having a little bit of both?
Yeah.
Those things will decide what you're going to be prescribing as a veterinarian.
Yeah.
So there's no point in doing egg counts early on. You're not going to get any useful information, but there's a lot of point in doing it right there at the weaning age.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one example. The other one, the other example of, you know, deworming horses without fecal egg counts. So
the recommendation that we have in the AAP guidelines is actually to sort of make sure all horses get one or two treatments a year, regardless of fecal egg counts. And then what you do use the fecal egg count for is to identify those horses, that subset of horses, that should then get additional treatments on top of those one or two treatments. And the whole point there is, okay, so why are we deworming horses based on egg counts? I talked about that in the webinar. It is to reduce that egg count, at least for that period of time. We also know that that's not going to last as long anymore as it used to. I mean, it used to be, you know, several months for moxidectin, a couple of months for ivermectin. Now we're down to four or five weeks in many cases. And so you shut that egg count down or you suppress it for a period of time. And so by that, you lower the infection pressure, but it's going to pick back up, right? You're not going to eliminate the worms from the horses. And I think that's a misconception that many people have. Mm. You're not going to eliminate the cyathostomins from the horses because there's going to be encysted larvae, and not even with moxidectin are you going to eliminate that completely. So there are going to be new worms establishing in new adult worms establishing in the intestinal tract, and they'll be producing eggs relatively soon after treatment. And so if you have a high setter, that high setter can be responsible for a large proportion of that infection pressure. So if you treat that horse a bit more than the others, then you're not treating the whole herd. You're treating just a subset of the horses. Mm. So you're leaving some horses untreated, but you are treating the ones that are primarily responsible. Then in the fall, you can also make sure that you get a tapeworm treatment in. We know, and that actually applies to Scandinavia as well. We know that tapeworms are definitely acquired over the course of the season. What is interesting about the tapeworms is that the whole tapeworm burden renews itself once a year. So they only last a year, then they get kicked out, and a new tapeworm burden establishes over the course of the next summer. And so... So there's a clear seasonality in that. And then horses that are not appropriately treated for tapeworms, some of those might be at risk for some of the tapeworm type or associated colics that I also talked about. Mm. And that typically happens over winter, especially in Scandinavian countries. So in the fall, in the autumn, having a good tapeworm treatment in there. Of course, you could do some of the diagnostics that will inform you whether the herd is in a high exposure or low or moderate exposure environment. And that could maybe inform you whether you need to treat more than once a year. But as a starting point, in most horses that have access to pasture, they should probably be treated for tapeworms at least once. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. And I already talked about using the egg counts in the transition period from ascaris to strongylate era. But then, you know, in that scenario, we're really using the egg counts in adult horses as we should, which is to find out, you know, which are the high shedders and then target those horses more, but still make sure that there's other parasites. One of the things that we can't not reliably always detect is Strongylus vulgaris. Even in egg count negative horses can have Strongylus vulgaris. And so they always have worms. You know, egg count negative horses always have worms. I mean, this just, the egg shedding is below a detection limit doesn't mean that they don't have worms. And so some of those horses will have Strongylus vulgaris. Yeah. I think that applies very much to Denmark and Sweden. And I think one of the reasons why we saw these increased prevalences in both countries was that, some of those farms that we surveyed in my study and the Swedish study had been basing all of the decisions on egg counts for many, many years.
Yeah.
And some horses just never have positive egg counts,
yeah,
which is great, right? Mm-hmm. But it meant that some of those horses had not been dewormed. Some of the horses had not been dewormed for 5 years.
Yeah.
No deworming. And so if you don't interrupt a life cycle for that many years, you know, every year you go, and especially in countries like Denmark and Sweden, where we know the parasite is around, chances of that horse picking up Strongylus vulgaris is definitely around, right? It's not a theoretical risk. It's actually a real risk. So if you don't interrupt or intervene with any treatment at any point in time, we definitely see an increased risk of Strongylus vulgaris. Now, most horses tolerate Strongylus vulgaris well, but as we discussed, there are these disease complexes that we don't want to see happening. Yeah. And so could you monitor for Strongylus vulgaris? Yes, you could. I mean, there's the PCR, there's the larval culture, and sometimes those can pick up vulgaris positive horses even when egg counts are negative. Yeah. So there are options.
Yeah, the recommendations in Sweden are that you should always do cultivation in the spring test.
Yeah, no, and I distinctly remember discussing this with the Swedish parasitology group there, Eva Tudén and her crew. And so, yeah, actually, the recommendation is, and there's some evidence behind this, the recommendation is to do the larval culture or the PCR, basically targeting the same stage, in the spring rather than in the fall, because in the spring you have a higher likelihood of the worms having reached the adult stage because they do that over winter. Whereas a little bit similar to with the tapeworms, they actually die out over summer and a new burden establishes. And so if you do it in the fall, most of those will still not have reached the adult stage in the fall. And therefore the chances of detecting a positive in the same horse is actually less in the fall compared to the spring. Spring is better for diagnosing, at least in the fecal samples, PCR or larval culture. Obviously, if you do the ELISA, which is not commercially available, so it wouldn't apply at this point. But if you did that, then that would detect antibodies year round, right? So. Yeah.